Adriatic, you telling me we have no assets that can find him? I don't want to hear that bullshit.
Calm down, began Wilson, but Top cut him off.
Don't you fucking tell me to calm down, snarled Top. Tell me you can find him. The man has an RFID chip, for God's sake, so does his dog.
Those chips went inactive 37 minutes after Havoc team entered the mansion, said Scott, his tone patient but not contrite. Unknown yet whether he removed the chips or is using a Faraday wrap on them.
Faraday wraps, like Faraday cages and bags, were sophisticated tech that nullified all electronic signals. Each member of the team carried them to secure devices taken from targets. The wraps were used to blank out RFID chips implanted in hostiles they apprehended. RTI policy forbade any team member from using them to shield their own telemetry. Those chips sent a continuous signal, even if the host died.
Or, continued Wilson, his tone as dour as an undertaker's, Bug thinks there's even a chance Ledger may have used a lightning bug. Some of the island's perimeter security and electronics went out shortly after Ledger left the building. And I'm not talking about the stuff Andrea took out during the mission. Ledger may have deliberately killed his own RFID. I've told the cleanup team to look for evidence.
Top looked up at the sky for a long moment, then rubbed his eyes.
Then how do we find him?
He asked wearily. Instead of a direct answer from Wilson, a new voice came on the line.
Pappy, said Mr. Church, we're on a confidential line, just the two of us.
Sir, said Tom, tell me exactly what happened. Be as detailed and precise as you can.
Top took a breath and then gave his report. He left nothing out and included his conjectures about Joe Ledger's crumbling mental state. He mentioned that Ledger had reported seeing someone in the woods, and then mentioned Dad later on. Church listened without interruption.
We thought it was rage, said Top. Without Law, I mean. He didn't go after us, though, but even so, maybe I should have hit him with Sandman just to be safe. This is on me.
You can secure that line of thinking right now, Pappy, said Church sternly. This is not on you, on any of you, end of discussion. Now, did Outlaw say anything before he left?
No, sir. I told him to go outside and get some air, and he did.
And you think he went straight to the pier and took a boat?
Yes, sir. Followed his footprints here, his and Ghost's. I'll retrace those steps to see if there's a spent dragonfly. Either way, he's gone. My guess is he used the sound of the choppers to cover the boat's engine noise.
Church was silent for a long time, but Top knew him well enough to understand that the big man was thinking things through. So he waited as the sun clawed its way over the horizon and turned the black waters to a sea of blood.
Pappy, said Church, I need you to listen very closely to what I have to say. You may not like it, and doubtless won't agree that this is the right play, but it's what I feel is best.
I already don't like the sound of it,
Top admitted glumly.
Let him go, said Church.
Say again?
You heard me. You and the rest of Havoc finish processing the island and then turn all materials over to the crew now on the ground. Come back here and write your after-action reports. I do not want you or any member of your team to go looking for Outlaw. I don't want to make it an order, however. I am asking for you to trust my judgment.
That's a big ask.
I know it is.
Top closed his eyes and contemplated putting his fist through the first really solid wall he could find.
Outlaw is way the hell out on the edge, he said. You didn't see what he did in there. Those people on the medical staff were monsters, no doubt, but they were unarmed. He chopped them into dog meat and pissed on their corpses. That's not the Outlaw we both know. He's crossed a line, and I don't know if leaving him alone out there is in his best interests. Have you run this past the docs?
By that he meant Dr. Rudy Sanchez, Joe Ledger's best friend and psychiatrist, and Dr. Jane Holliday. the head of the RTI Integrated Sciences Division. Both of them had argued against Ledger being cleared for this mission. The arguments had gotten heated, but Church won because Church tended to win. And now this.
"This is my call," said Church.
"Mine alone." Top sighed and sat down on a piling.
"You're a religious man, aren't you?"
Church paused again.
"In my own way."
"So am I, though it's getting harder and harder to hold on to that."
"What's your point, Pappy?"
"My point is that we're maybe compounding a sin,"
said Top.
"Maybe committing another sin by doing nothing to help Outlaw."
"I believe this is the best way to help him."
"Then if he continues to go down this road, may God have mercy on our souls, because any drop of innocent blood he spills is on us."
He waited for Church to answer, but when he tapped the comms, it was clear the line had gone dead. Interlude 6. Sales presentation via showroom 5 months ago.
"One of the optional extras in this package is what we like to call a self-cleaning oven," said Mr. Sunday, beaming a great smile. "Exfiltration after a highly dangerous operation is always a challenge, isn't it? If the assets are captured, then there is a risk of them becoming chatty during enhanced interrogation. That leads to way too many complications, not the least of which is creating a cause for your enemies to rally around and to garner international support, and frankly, who needs that? It's expensive, embarrassing, and unnecessary."
He took a small computer chip from an inner pocket and placed it on a wooden stool, then walked over and stood behind a sheet of 3-inch thick lead hung by chains from the ceiling. The audience could see him in the chair on split screen. Mr. Sunday removed his cell phone.
"We call it 3B, which is short for a nickname given to it by a pop culture-obsessed senior tech on our team. It stands for Burn Baby Burn."
He paused and grinned.
"We should probably give that particular tech a vacation somewhere with nice, quiet scenery."
Mr. Sunday chuckled at his own joke and made sure the laugh was only 3 short beats. Fun, but not silly. Jovial, without losing the edge.
"The chemical compound in that chip is proprietary," he said, "and is not for sale at any price, and I highly recommend you not trying to remove one of these chips from any PMC you lease or purchase from us. Resist all temptation to analyze a compound. Each chip is synced to the heartbeat of the operative, and if that pulse rate goes below 20 beats per minute, the chip detonates. Allow me to demonstrate."
He pressed a button on his phone and the chip exploded. The blast was immediate and massive, far beyond what any of the audience could possibly have expected. It obliterated the wooden stool and a good portion of the floor and left smoking pits all across the surface of the lead shield.
"Burn, baby, burn," said Mr. Sunday, waving smoke away.
A very pretty young woman, dressed in a short skirt and an extremely low-cut top, stretched across improbably large and firm breasts, came mincing out from backstage with a bright yellow fire extinguisher. She flashed a lot of white teeth at the people on the screens, then doused the fire, gave the hole in the floor a final playful blast, gave the audience a saucy little curtsy, and pranced off. Mr. Sunday came out from behind the lead barrier and blew a kiss at her retreating back. The woman turned, pretended to catch the kiss, and placed it daintily on her left cheek.
"The chemical compound is, as you can see, quite a corker," said Mr. Sunday. "It is designed to burn at such a high temperature and at such an accelerated rate of speed that it leaves no traces of itself and very few of whatever is in its blast radius. The weapons, uniform, and equipment used by the PMCs are likewise prepped with chips keyed to that specific operative. That means any forensic analysis will have a hard darn time making sense of anything, and let's not forget, even if they are somehow able to salvage pieces of the device, nothing is traceable."
The weapons, equipment, and even the clothes are all manufactured by us under controlled situations. There is no trail to follow.
He used his clicker to bring images onto his screen and those of the people watching from their private spaces around the globe. A graphic of data streams appeared showing heart rate, blood pressure, respiration, and other details. The telemetry sent by the chip is constantly monitored, and you would have access to the data feeds. You would have access to the detonation code, and the purchase price gives you the option of using that code whenever you want, or not. Just remember, though, it is much more cost-effective to purchase a few new PMCs for new missions than to repurpose the old ones. No muss, no fuss. Like, say, walking into the middle of a crowd of political dissidents or protesters with the wrong slogans on their signs. Oh, heck, folks, you could have a couple of these lads take a tour of a state house or presidential palace and poof, suddenly there is no opposition leader and no one to be arrested, interrogated, or tried. Now, how's that for making a political statement? Oh, hell yes. His eyes swirled with color as he stepped forward, passing through a downspill of green light. For a moment, even the whites of his eyes vanished as sickly greens and toxic yellow browns eddied. Then he took another half step forward, and his eyes were normal. His smile was broad and affable. A kindly, slightly corny old uncle or a cliched storekeeper from some old episode of Gunsmoke or Leave It to Beaver.
Now, he said, let's see if we can get us a yummy little bidding war going on here.
Days of Darkness, Part 2. Revenge is a confession of pain. Latin proverb. But if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. Exodus, chapter 21, verses 23 through 25. Chapter 15. Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece. Scott Wilson stood under a canopy outside the security office, watching the big helicopter land. It was a huge Boeing CH-47 Chinook, nearly 100 feet long, with twin propellers spun by a pair of powerful Lycoming turboshaft engines. It had come out of the dawn like some mythic beast, but landed as softly as a butterfly on the tarmac behind Phoenix House. The noise diminished, and the massive blades began to slow. The rear hatch eased down with a soft hydraulic whine, revealing a knot of shadowed figures within. Wilson walked out to meet Havoc team as they descended from the bird. They all wore black trousers and tank tops, no other gear or weapons, except for Belle, who had a rifle case slung across her back. No one ever handled her guns but her. Bunny, Andrea, and Belle walked past Wilson with barely a nod. Only Top paused to talk with the chief of operations. The soldier looked older by 10 years than he had when he'd set out with Havoc team for the mission. Top's face was more deeply lined, his eyes red-rimmed, and his posture stooped with a weariness that ran miles deeper than mere physical exhaustion. Wilson offered his hand, and Top looked at it for a moment before taking it.
The medical teams are still triaging the prisoners you liberated, Wilson said. The Chinook is going to refuel and head back as soon as they're ready for transport. Our doctor on the ground there says that all but one of them is likely to recover. Sad that we'll lose any of them, but...
Top took a toothpick from his pocket and put it between his teeth. He chewed on the pointy end for a few silent seconds, working it from one corner of his mouth to the other. His dark eyes were completely unreadable.
You did good work tonight, said Wilson.
Top shook his head.
Did we? Well, sorry, boss, but I'm not putting this one in the win column, no damned way.
He started to walk away, but Wilson hurried to catch up.
We will find Colonel Ledger.
Top snorted.
You'll find him exactly when and where he wants to be found.
We have considerable resources, or have you forgotten?
Top stopped and turned to him.
How do I put this, Scott? If Joe wants to be found, you'll find him. If he doesn't, then you probably won't. But if he doesn't want to be found and you do ping him, you'd better make sure you only send operators you don't care about, because they may not come back in one piece.
I began Wilson, but Top cut him off.
I have to write my after-action report, get fed, get some rack time, and then Farm Boy and I are out of here in the morning. I'd rather cancel this other thing, the gig in the States, because I'd rather be here, but like I said, hunting Colonel Ledger isn't going to move the needle on what we're trying to do. Appreciate you trying to be cheerleader for the team, Scott, but stop trying it on me.
He walked away. Wilson stood on the tarmac for quite a while, staring at the door Top Sims had closed behind him when he'd entered the building. Interlude 7. The Pavilion. Blue Diamond Elite Training Center, Stevens County, Washington, 5 months ago. Rafael Santoro, Kuga, and Eve stood in a little cluster with HK as the trainees filed out. Two of them required stretchers. Six others had to be helped by their comrades. Everyone who'd participated in the drill was marked in one way or another.
That was a good session, said Kuga. Those sons of bitches can fight.
You should know, said HK.
Flatterer, laughed Kuga, and he gave her a pat on the back.
Telling the truth. These men and women have studied videos of you, too, and Raphael, of course.
She glanced at Eve.
I don't suppose there are any of you?
Eve said nothing, and HK shrugged.
We are fortunate to have collected so many. The tapes from Oslo, of course, but also some hacked from the servers from the DMS raid on the Dragon Factory and elsewhere.
The Dragon what?
Asked Eve.
It was a genetics development facility on Dogfish Key in the Bahamas. The Jacoby twins ran it.
Oh,
Eve said slowly.
Yeah, I read about them in one of the files. Freaky albinos, right? Brother and sister who fucked each other? Wasn't their father some kind of Nazi?
How well you summarize it,
said Santoro.
She's not wrong, though, said Kuga. Paris and Hecate were freaks, no matter from which angle you looked at them. Brilliant, but weird on a level that even gives me the Wiggins.
Eve echoed the word Wiggins, enjoying it.
Point is, said HK, we have enough good, real combat footage of Joe Ledger to make sure our training supervisors can use them effectively. There are some truly outstanding fighters in our team, and that's before the enhancements. Later this afternoon, we'll have a chance to see what our next-generation fixers can do.
Next generation?
Echoed Eve, posing it as a question.
Are you talking that exoskeleton stuff?
HK shared a brief secret smile with Kuga and Santoro.
Exosuits, to be sure, she said. But we have some other surprises that I can truly guarantee will raise a smile on all your faces. I think it's fair to say that the American operation is going to be quite the event.
Now that, said Kuga, is what I like to hear.
Yeah,
said Eve, more to herself than anyone.
Me too.
Chapter 16. Il Pomodoro Beach, Lungomare Marina Italiana, Giovanazzi, Puglia, Italy. The two young men came out of the restaurant, exiting through a staff door which they closed and locked. The place was closed for the night, and they were exhausted from hours of cleaning, restocking, and pre-work for the next day. Enea was the short, fat one, a deputy chef and shift manager. Federico, known to all his friends as Spike because he looked vaguely like the character from the old American TV show Buffy the Vampire Slayer, was the tall, skinny one. Spike had started bleaching his hair white and spiking it after having met the actor who played Spike at the big comic convention in Lucca.
It didn't matter that the waitstaff, all of whom were at least a decade younger, had no idea who Buffy or Spike were. They liked the nickname, though. Most women he met thought it was a euphemism for how well he was hung. They were best friends and had worked at this restaurant, and two previous ones, since high school. Whenever possible, they worked the same shifts, Anea running the kitchen on the evening shifts whenever the head chef was on days, and Spike doing prep work and cleanup after the last customer was gone. They cranked up the sound system and blasted old Italian punk, with a heavy bias toward De Rosa and Pancreas. The screaming vocals rattled the glassware and made the whole cleanup process fun and fast. Their post-work ritual was to go down to the big rocks by the water, smoke some good Turkish weed if there were no polizia around, or smoke their way through three or four Benson and Hedges Reds while talking about politics and watching the stars. Tonight was a canapa night, and the joints were fresh and potent, spiked with something special that brought them quickly to a nice level and softened the edges of reality. They sat on their favorite rocks and felt the day slough off. They were aware of the many dark birds, ravens and crows and cormorants clustered on the surrounding rocks, in the trees, or on the hoods of cars, but neither much cared. There were always birds by the water's edge, and so what if these were black instead of white? The only thought either gave was Spike briefly wishing he'd brought a bag of table scraps with him, and he filed it away to do some other night. Anea talked about owning his own restaurant one day. Spike talked about how he'd like to ask out Gioia, the hostess, if her damned divorce ever went through. A lot of their conversations were retreads, but they didn't care. They were doing okay in their lives, still young enough to enjoy the world and content to be in each other's company after another long, good day. The structure of the night changed dramatically, though, when they saw the boat. It came out of the night, pushing a bow wave, showing no lights at all, like something emerging from a dream, mysterious and a bit spooky. Only the muted growl of its engines, idling low as the boat moved toward the rocks, gave it any sense of reality. Spike tapped Anea and pointed. They'd lived on the coast all their lives and knew boats, but this was something special. A German-built Cigarette 59 Tirana, a sleek black hull with red interior and seats, the color visible in the starlight. A monster racing boat that had to run 2 or 3 million euros. It looked brand new.
Accidente, breathed Anea. Dio santo,
agreed Spike. Then for a moment they froze because the unreality of such a boat appearing out of the night was suddenly made nightmarish as they caught a glimpse of the pilot. It was not a man at all. The creature they saw had a huge, shaggy head, covered entirely in white fur, flecked with a red deeper than the boat's interior. That red was smeared all over the thing's elongated muzzle.
Licantropo!
Cried Anea. They were practical young men who did not believe in werewolves, but here was a gigantic wolf piloting a ghostly boat. They were also very seriously stoned. Their mellow high turned to terror in a heartbeat, and as the boat slowed and ground onto the rocky sand below where they were sitting, they leaped to their feet and fled, shrieking about werewolves. The boat came to a softly rocking stop. The monstrous white dog stood up, then climbed over the windscreen and onto the bow. His pale fur glowed like silver in the cold starlight. The man who had been in the other pilot's chair killed the engine, plunging the small stretch of coast into silence, except for the fading footfalls of the two restaurant employees. Their continual yelps, prayers, and curses lingered long after they vanished down a side street. Then the man clambered out of the boat and onto the rocks. His clothes were dark, and the angle of approach had hidden him behind the dog. He clicked his tongue for the dog, who leaped from the bow to the rocks and then followed the man up to the street. They lingered for only a moment as the man oriented himself. Then they faded into darkness and were gone long before anyone came to investigate. The night birds watched them go, and then one by one, lifted off the sea-soaked rocks, and followed. Chapter 17 Integrated Sciences Division, Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece. Dr. Jane Holliday sat perched on a stool, sipping tea from a delicate china cup, the saucer held between thumb and index finger of her other hand. She was the calm center of a storm of activity as handlers brought in dozens of boxes of paper printouts, crates of laptops, cell phones, and hard drives. Another team, dressed in lemon-yellow biohazard suits, carried special metal boxes boldly stenciled with the distinctive symbol, the four stylized circles of which representing the infection chain of agent, host, source, and transmission. These boxes went into a cold room guarded by two stone-faced guards with automatic rifles at port arms.
"Wow," said Isaac Breslau, Doc Holliday's senior research assistant. "That's a lot of stuff."
"Yippers," said Doc happily. "They got it all, soup to nuts. No one at that site had the presence of mind to delete the data or toss a lit cigarette butt into the file cabinets. Might as well be Christmas morning."
"Sure, but only if there's something of use in there," said Isaac. He was a very short man, barely above 5 feet tall, which made him quite a comical companion to Doc, who was over a foot taller. And while Isaac was slim as a sword blade, Doc was what her Jewish aunt used to call zaftig, curves upon curves. The running joke was that Doc looked like a younger Dolly Parton on growth hormones, which was not entirely inaccurate, even down to the embroidered cowboy shirts and hand-tooled boots. Doc, who had endured being a figure of fun as a girl, having grown to double D cups by 10th grade, decided to stop trying to hide and instead use her body as both a distraction and a challenge. People too dim to look past the bust line, wildly coiffed blonde curls, and oversized hourglass figure did so at their peril. It meant they didn't bother to look into Doc's eyes and see the scathing humor and bottomless intellect. While most of the kids in high school were trying to get laid, she was filing her first dozen patents. She was born poor, graduated high school 3 years early, and with $4 million in a new trust account. She blew through the corporate world, racking up more patents and more millions, then fell in with the Defense Department eggheads at DARPA until they started to bore her. When Mr. Church offered her carte blanche to do any side research she wanted, while also overseeing the Integrated Sciences Division, first with the DMS and then in an even more expanded capacity with RTI, she jumped at it. It was refreshing to work for someone who was not her intellectual inferior. Isaac Breslau was not on the same level as Doc, though he wasn't that many floors below. A professor of biological engineering from MIT with a handful of master's degrees in chemistry, materials science, and health sciences. They'd met at a conference in Zurich and fell in together thick as thieves because they were in a room of brilliant minds, but were clearly, in terms of intellect, the big dogs in the room. Doc had hired Isaac, and when he saw the sophistication of the RTI science labs, he nearly wept.
"There'll be something we can use, Lamb Chop," she said.
Doc was fond of diminutives with everyone, except Church, at least not to the boss's face. Not often, anyway.
"We'll pick all the meat off it and suck out the marrow.
First, ew," said Isaac, "and second, I agree."
They watched the workers move in a constant line like ants going out to forage, bringing back goodies and heading out for another load.
"How much of this is there?"
Doc looked at a clipboard, flipped over a few pages.
3 tons of paper, 2 tons of computers, including several Fujitsu Fugaku supercomputers,"
Isaac sniffed. "Last year's models." Doc grinned.
"Yeah, once we strip them out, we can sell them for a nickel at a yard sale."
"They're mine,"
said a voice.
"Calling dibs."
They turned to see a slim young black man come hustling into the room. He wore an open bathrobe over pajama bottoms and a t-shirt with the big red Superman symbol on the chest.
"Well, hell," said Doc.
We've gone and woke little Bug from his beauty sleep, and aren't you cute in your little blue PJs? They told me they were bringing back hardware, said Bug, stopping by the two scientists. But this is kind of a jackpot. Again, said Isaac, only if there's something worth finding. Bug cocked an eyebrow at Doc. He's cheerful tonight. He needs a foot rub and some hot cocoa, said Doc. Stop it, said Isaac, but she ignored him. A lab tech came over with paper cups of coffee for the three of them, and they sipped and watched. After several minutes, during which the incoming crates and boxes grew to resemble the Grand Tetons around them, Isaac sighed and said, Are we going to drink bad coffee, make jokes, and not talk about the elephant in the room? Doc sipped and shook her head. Bug set his cup down and rubbed his eyes. I keep telling myself Joe's going to be okay. Joe, said Doc slowly, has never been okay since I met him. He is, by any clinical interpretation of psychology, a bag of rabid hamsters. What he went through at Christmas messed that boy up so bad that he should never, and I mean never, ever have been allowed anywhere near a field op. Rudy Sanchez might disagree, said Isaac. Rudy Sanchez is at home with his son and very pregnant wife in Corfu, said Doc. Besides, ever since our boy got out of the hospital, Rudy has been lobbying for Joe to step down from field work. He's badgered Mr. Church just about every damn day. And yet Church sent Ledger out on this mission, said Isaac. Granted, I haven't been around Church as long as you two have, but this feels like it's out of character for the big man, too. Bug picked up his coffee cup, stared into it, and set it down again. No comment, he said. Isaac shook his head. We don't even know where Ledger's gone. It's been hours now. God only knows what intel he got from those people he butchered is the word you're looking for, said Doc. Let's not be imprecise. Fine, said Isaac, though he didn't actually repeat the word. We don't know where Ledger's off to. He has no resources, no backup. I heard the top Sims wasn't even sure if Ledger took any weapons or equipment with him. Oh, honey bear, said Doc. That's one thing you don't ever have to worry about. Jolton Joe's trained for this kind of thing. He knows how to acquire money, equipment, and other resources. He might even ask nicely for some of it, but let's face it, for a man as skilled and resourceful as he is, do you really think for one blessed moment that he's going to let anything get in his way? Bug sighed. What I'm really afraid of is Joe finding a quiet place to stick one of those gun barrels up under his chin and see if that stops the pain. It was such a cold, frank, and plausible statement that it sucked all the warmth out of the room. Chapter 18. Barikaro Wotila Airport, Viale Enzo Ferrari, Bari, Italy. The fat old man with the emotional support dog waited nearly 40 minutes for the payphone to be free. Coin phones were harder to come by lately, and this one seemed very popular. He watched a nun use it, then a teenage boy wearing a Pro Italia Galatina football jersey, and then a woman with a baby. Why none of them had cell phones this far into the 21st century was a mystery. The old man waited until there was no one around to observe him, and then he waddled over to the wall-mounted phone and thumbed in some coins. The fact that he wore gloves to do this also went unobserved. He let the phone ring while he stood there, eyes closed, one hand clutched tightly around the handset, the other balled into a fist at his side. When the woman answered, the man sagged against the wall as if he'd been punched. There were tears in his eyes, and his breath was a ragged wheeze.
Hello?
The woman's voice was soft, tentative, and uncertain, almost as if she suspected but did not believe who was calling. The fat old man said nothing.
Hello, who's calling?
Asked the woman. He did not reply. Then she said,
Joe?
That one word. Soft, scared, hopeful.
It took so much of what he had left inside to speak.
I love you, Junie.
And then he hung up, whirled, and fled. The dog followed as the man hurried toward the closest trash can, and it stood guard while the man vomited. Chapter 19. Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece. Church woke in the lightless depths of the night with a name on his lips. It tasted like blood and bile. He reached for Lilith, but her side of the bed was empty. Then he saw her by the window, standing so still, her naked silhouette a study in tension. He could read that in every line, from the rigidity of her back muscles to the fist clenched tightly beneath her chin. Without turning, she said,
"He is alive in the world again."
He. She didn't need to say the name, they both knew. And they were both afraid. Interlude 8. The Pavilion, Blue Diamond Elite Training Center, Stevens County, Washington, 4 months ago. Eve was alone, even though she had company. That was how things were since Adam died. Men came and went through her life, in and out of her bed, coasting on the far edge of her awareness. She kissed them, had sex with them, sometimes made them have sex with one another. She used them hard. She even killed one of them once just to see if that would make her feel anything. It didn't, and it was messy and a bit disgusting. Two of her other men had to clean things up. HK tried to scold her, but Eve walked away and locked herself in her bedroom. That had been, when? 2 weeks before? A bit longer? She couldn't tell. Time, like so many other things, had lost its meaning. The only highlights of her day, the only thing that gave her any joy and brought her to a sharp focus, were the visits. Daddy came and sat with her, telling her things he wanted her to learn, filling her mind with plans about how they were going to find Joe Ledger, find him, capture him, and spend days, weeks, ruining him, breaking his will and his heart, turning his body into a cage of broken pieces, feeding him on pain and making sure the doctors did not let him die. Eve wasn't even sure she wanted him to die. No. It would be so much better if Ledger were turned into a cripple. Maybe with no feet and just a few fingers on each hand. He'd only really need one eye. He wouldn't need his cock or balls. Daddy said that a man could be reduced to something barely recognizable as having been human and still survive. A person like that could live for years, kept in a cage or given a little dolly to push himself around on. No teeth, no nose, no hope. And together they would drive him to the very edge of madness, but not push him over. No, she wouldn't want that. She and Daddy wanted him alive, so he could be aware every single day of what he'd become, and to live with the knowledge that everyone he loved was either dead or being similarly destroyed. Whom, then, should they remove from Ledger's life first? Always a delicious speculation. Church, of course. Both Daddy and Kuga wanted that spooky prick dead and run through a wood chipper. Junie Flynn, yeah, she had to go. Eve wanted to hand her over to two dozen of the biggest, ugliest, meanest fixers, and then tape every moment of their fun and games with her. The others, too. The big, stupid white guy with all the muscles? Dead. The black man who looked too old to be a soldier? Dead. The bitch with the sniper rifle and the gay Italian guy? Dead. Dead. All of them dead. Not quickly, and not all at once, but dead in the end. And their deaths shone on movie screens 10 times bigger than life, so Joe Ledger could watch every single day. The very thought of that made her feel. It made her weep. It made her scream. It kept her completely alive. Chapter 20. Integrated Sciences Division, Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece. Doc and Isaac stood side by side, looking at the material brought from the island. Folding tables had been brought in and arranged like spokes on a wheel, radiating outward from where they stood. Each table represented a specific branch of science. Scott Wilson found them and threaded his way through boxes of additional materials that littered the floor, creating a labyrinth.
"Good Lord,"
Wilson said when he reached the center and stood by the two scientists.
"What is all this?"
"It's the hall from Mislav Mitrovich's lab," said Doc.
Wilson glanced from one table to the next.
"Is there a method to this madness?"
"Well," Doc said, "a couple of hours ago I'd have said that it was just a mishmash of records from a bunch of unrelated lines of research."
She tapped one table with a bright blue fingernail.
"For example, here we have some pretty advanced work on neural memory chips, including some off-market studies on closed-loop neural prosthetics clearly purposed for military use."
Tap.
"Here we have what are clearly stolen documents from DARPA focusing on human-machine fusion. That's cyborgs to you, Scotty, sweetie. A well-funded and long-range program to determine how best to integrate machine parts to human combat soldiers, with an eye to having a cybernetic ground force by 2050. But there's also a lot of material here, including very sophisticated schematics that leads me to believe that actual development is much further along. Some of that seems like it's in-house development by Kuga's group of Frankensteins, because those newer reports aren't written in the DOD-friendly military doublespeak."
Tap.
"Here, we jump into biochemistry, specifically eugeroics," Doc said. "And before you embarrass yourself by telling me you don't know what that big word means, it's the science of developing wakefulness-promoting drugs, ostensibly for dealing with a raft of sleep disorders from narcolepsy to idiopathic hypersomnia, with some very specific train stops in between. But Isaac here, who I should tell you is more than just a hobbit-sized stud muffin, thinks that some of this research ties into a case that Church started a bunch of years ago and Ledger wrapped while on a gig in Paris with violin. The bulk of this research is new stuff, and it's not the kind of thing that's going to play well with labor unions. There are reports in there for use in factory workers to permit them to work shifts of 40 to 60 continuous hours. And that's like combining a sweatshop with the Boston Marathon. And references to research lines with military applications. Think about that. Soldiers on a specific mission who don't need to sleep and don't tire even with constant movement and exertion."
Tap.
"Then this stack is science straight out stolen from us, and I think it was back before my time, during that time Mind Reader was being bent over a barrel and rogered, before Bug gave her a big old makeover. There's data here that I know for sure we took from the Jacobies, from the Dragon Factory run by Paris and Hackett, and from their father Cyrus. There are extracts from Zephyr Bain, from Sebastian Galt, from the Seven Kings, from maybe 20 of the cases the DMS worked on, and all of it is coded. Bug thinks the codes are a cross-indexing system, and he put someone on it to figure out how it works."
She tapped another, but then hesitated.
"I could go on," she said. "Bottom line is that this is both a jackpot and a big old ball of confusion."
"How so?"
asked Wilson.
"Well, on one hand, it's a treasure trove that will, I hope, give us a clearer peek inside Kuga's research and development process. Given enough time, we might be able to determine what they've been working on and the likely applications of the same. Except that it may not be as random as it appears,"
said Isaac.
"Correctamundo," agreed Doc.
Wilson chewed his lip as he wandered around looking at the mountains of material. Without turning, he said,
"The manifests say that they were biological samples. Is there anything there that might explain this?"
Oh, hell, Sugar Bear, said Doc. There's 40 kinds of bioweapons. We have full specs on some, and Rage is in there, by the way. And then there are some that all we have are samples, but no specs. Those are in a hot room, and I have people studying them.
What about the people, the, test subjects?
We turn them over to my big Woolly Bear and his team. The patients are in quarantine.
Woolly Bear was Dr. Ronald Coleman. He was a molecular biologist who oversaw a division of integrated sciences dealing with the hunt for what he called disease identity, a radical new field of diagnostics.
He'll suss out what was done to them, Doc assured him.
Some of those folks have implants, said Isaac, and we think that's where a lot of this ties together.
In what way, exactly?
Asked Wilson. Isaac smiled. His smiles always looked like he was wincing from some mild abdominal pain.
The more we tried to separate out the different fields of science here, the more they seem to want to clump together. I mean, especially if we start with a what's the worst that can happen point of view. And if you start with the idea of cybernetic implants for soldiers and add a cocktail of chemicals to enhance stamina and wakefulness, then what we might be looking at is a very damned scary new kind of super soldier. Or, added Doc, if you stir in some nasty short-duration high-effect bioweapons as a possible payload, we could be seeing the birth of the next generation of suicide bomber. A virtually unkillable soldier who is faster, stronger, and able to fight his way into a crowded airport, a major concert, or a sports event, and make himself go boom.
Scott Wilson stared at them, and he could feel the blood drain from his face.
You were right, said Isaac to Doc. You said he would look like that.
Chapter 21. Sales Presentation via Showroom.
Hello, my friends, said Mr. Sunday. Welcome back. How delightful to see all of you, and a big welcome to some new folks who have joined us. I know that several of you are here on the recommendation of regular and satisfied customers. Don't forget to ask me about the new customer premiums after the regular presentation.
Mr. Sunday was dressed in a lightweight wool suit with a hand-painted tie and polished oxblood loafers. He looked like he was ready to host a cocktail mixer at a tech conference, all casual smiles and relaxed posture.
We live in a troubled world, he said. There are all kinds of problems out there, both foreign and domestic. Access to the internet has allowed for unification of dissident voices, which in turn has led to strikes and walkouts, work slowdowns, and pressure from global watchdog groups. Our police forces are under siege for doing their jobs, and soldiers following sensible orders are being tried as war criminals. It's getting to the point that we are being prevented from running our companies and our countries the way they need to be run. Are you with me still?
He began pacing slowly, making sure that at any given moment he was making eye contact with one of the potential buyers. He made sure to make such contact with every face on those screens. He would let his eyes linger, forcing contact until he saw a tell. A nod, a tilt of the head, a smile, or even a wince. Everyone had a tell, and what mattered was how they reacted relative to what he was saying, down to key words he used and subtle inflections intended to evoke those reactions. His pace was slow, but his hands moved at varying speed, each gesticulation giving emphasis to some point, much as a conductor's baton will.
A corresponding challenge, he said, is that public pressure, growing out of trending social media outrage, often results in either stock drops, knee-jerk legislation, the implementation of regulations imposed by whoever is up for election and wants to appeal to key demographics, and also the courts. What was it Shakespeare said? First kill all the lawyers. I'm for that. Except our lawyers, of course.
His laugh was warm and inclusive, a we-all-get-this thing.
The days when we could just send in a quality control team seemed to be passing.
He leaned on those words, casting them as catch-all euphemisms that his customers could apply as needed.
And the resulting lawsuits are obscene. The amounts that juries are awarding these days is beyond absurd. All that class action attorneys have to do is show 10 seconds of footage from a smartphone, and the jurors start adding zeros to the amount awarded to the plaintiffs.
He paused and turned toward the full bank of screens and gave 3 measured seconds of his full presence.
What if we could control each of those kinds of moments? He asked calmly. What if we could control what is, and more to the point, what is not recorded? What is not allowed to be shared on Twitter or Instagram or any other social media platform?
He paused.
And what if, in those moments of actual privacy, we could completely resolve the situation? Whether that is an arrest in one of the more problematic parts of one of our cities, or a field operation to resolve a political inconvenience, or a money-shredding strike at a factory.
Another pause.
What if each of us possessed the technology to completely own that moment and to later control any messaging? What if, here, in the third decade of the 21st century, we could move and act with the cost-efficient impunity of the 1950s? Yes, I can see that you see the potential, but my friends, let me actually show you how this played out for one of our clients. I share this with the full permission of that client, who is a very happy returning customer. Settle back and watch.
Chapter 22. Real Sport Factory, Mutiara Village, Central Java, Indonesia. Darmana was a very small woman, under 5 feet, less than 90 pounds, but she stood tall as the two men approached her. Behind her, 40 other women, including several who were barely into their teens, shrank back. However, Darmana stood firm, arms wide, as if she could shield the other workers from what was coming. A few men, employed in the same factory to carry and package the heavy boxes of sneakers, sweatshirts, and other branded items, hung at the fringes of the group. They looked ready to run, and more than half of them had already deserted the protest. And Darmana held fast. One of the two men wore a lightweight gray business suit that probably cost as much as she made in a year. He wore a crisp white shirt and striped red and gray tie. A very expensive-looking gold wristwatch caught bits of sunlight as his arms moved. He had thinning hair brushed to conceal the paucity and gold-rimmed steel glasses. He was smiling in the wrong kind of way for what was happening.
"He's from the corporation,"
murmured a woman behind her.
"He's come to fire us."
That sent a ripple of nervous chatter through the group, but Darmana shushed them.
"He doesn't have police with him," she said. "None of those thugs, either. Let's hear what he has to say."
Her eyes, though, flicked to the other man. The other was not one of the factory managers or supervisors. He was a stranger to her. He did not wear a suit and tie, or even a sports shirt, which was better suited to the oppressive heat. Instead, he was dressed head to toe in loose-fitting black clothes that looked like something a soldier might wear, except there were no emblems or insignia. No weapons, either. The men walked slowly toward her. 2 more men, dressed in the same black clothes, leaned against a dark SUV, muscular arms folded across their chests, eyes hidden behind sunglasses.
"Just be calm," said Darmana quietly. "Maybe they've come to talk."
This was day 6 of the shutdown. Darmana and her supporters had used chains, ropes, even plastic zip ties to seal the doors to the factory.
For one glorious day, everyone was behind her. All 88 workers, and even two of the shift supervisors, though they were likely spies sent to learn about the new union's plans. Now there were 40 protesters left. Some of the others stayed home, claiming they were sick. A few went looking for other work, finding it in similar sweatshops. And a dozen had climbed into the factory through a rear window and were actually working, hoping to curry favor with the supervisors once the protest was squashed, as it would certainly be. The government favored the corporations, as it always had. The world press was denied access to the town once the strike started, and only hand-picked reporters were allowed to cover the event. What they wrote was mostly cut and pasted from corporate headquarters, the government's public relations office, or from articles from The Capitalist and other magazines or news services slanted toward the owners. Darmana had read a few of those. Articles that said the pay rate of RP 22,453.90 was more than enough to live on in both comfort and luxury. Those articles written for Western readers who would be drawn to the number and not the value. In truth, the rupee was crumbling, and this factory's pay rate of RP 99,379.29 worked out to $6.45 in American dollars, below even the national minimum wage, not enough to survive on, what with agriculture production still recovering from COVID-19 and stores raising their prices to maximize profits during shortages. More than 70% of Darmana's meager pay went to food, and that was hardly a feast. Many working parents like her were half-starved so that their children and grandparents could eat. Debt mounted, and since the company that owned the factory also controlled the banks, there was nowhere to go but further down the poverty hole. Darmana had hoped that by forming a small union and blockading the factory, the corporation fat cats would realize it was better to offer sensible, if small, raises rather than lose money from production slowdowns. She'd sent carefully written letters to the executives and foremen pleading for those raises. Not a lot. The workers did not want to leave their jobs, but was it too much to ask for money to live? To put enough food on the table, to buy clothes for the children, to buy school books, and to have enough for them to visit a clinic every now and then? It was so little to ask. Some of the celebrity-endorsed sneakers made in her factory sold for anywhere from $800 to $6,000 American dollars. 6,000 was three times as much as Darmana earned in a year, working 14-hour shifts 6 days a week. Surely the executives would find it in their hearts to offer a little more. Only a little. At first, it had been the factory manager yelling at her and the other workers to go back to work, promising to forgive and forget once the machines were running again. When that hadn't worked, mainly because Darmana knew that retaliation would follow and told her co-workers that, the management sent strikebreakers. There were some minor scuffles, but many of her neighbors who'd come to watch the drama had cell phones. The strikebreakers were too clearly villains, and if it got onto social media, then corporate stocks would drop. Darmana was not deeply educated, but she was savvy. She understood the power of social media. She had her cousin's cell phone, and she raised it as the corporate man and the tougher-looking man in black approached her. They came right up to her and stopped only a few feet away, with the one who looked like a soldier a pace back. The corporate man stopped so close that Darmana could have reached out and touched him. She tried to stop the hand holding the cell phone from trembling, but she was too frightened. It was hard to say who frightened her more, the corporate man who could fire her and everyone else here, or the man in black. There was something awful about him. He was taller than the well-dressed man and much taller than she was. He looked to be over 6 feet, with broad shoulders and a powerful build, a white man with maybe a bit of West African blood, handsome in his way, except for the eyes.
They were as cold and dead as stones. The corporate man broke the silence. He spoke Indonesian with an accent that she could not place. Not American, maybe German? She wasn't sure.
"My name is Michael Augustus Stafford," he said. "Your name is Damana, right? You are the leader of this little protest?"
It wasn't a question, so Damana merely waited for more.
"What you are doing is hurting business," said Michael Augustus Stafford. "It's hurting your friends and co-workers. Surely you understand that you've already lost much in wages, that you'll never be able to recoup. How is that helping any of you?"
"You're paying starvation wages," she said,
trying to keep fear out of her voice.
"No one here is fainting from hunger," said Stafford.
He managed a smile that showed very good teeth. His breath, however, stank of cigars and whiskey. Darmana didn't even bother to reply to that. Everyone who worked at the factory was stick thin. She had two children at home, the oldest of whom would soon leave school at age 12 to work right alongside her mother. Her daughter told her that she dreamed they were all dead, and the town was filled with pikong, ghosts who were stuck in their shrouds. Only the factory was a big shroud in which all of the ghosts worked forever and ever. Stafford shook his head.
"Damana, you need to listen to reason. No, let me change that. You need to think about what's best for you and your children, for your elderly mother and your grandparents. You need to think about what's best for all of the people here and their families. What good can possibly come of you causing trouble and keeping the others, your own friends and neighbors, from earning their pay? You see, it's not the management who are picking your pockets, hardly. We provide jobs for everyone. No, it's you. And people like you who complain even when you're well off. It's people like you who are never satisfied and certainly never grateful."
"Grateful to be slaves?"
she fired back. The camera she held above her head felt like it weighed 10 tons. Beads of sweat ran down her arm.
"Grateful to have work," corrected Stafford. "Grateful to have steady employment at a time when the whole world is reeling from the global financial meltdown. Hundreds of millions around the world, even in Europe and America, are still out of work, but you have work. And here you are, loitering, idle, causing problems, making false accusations against the people who provide those jobs to you. People you should praise. Instead, you berate them and make false accusations. You concoct blog posts filled with lies, exaggerated claims, and clips from fake news sources."
"It's not fake," snapped Darmana. "I've worked here all my life. I know. Everything I've said in letters and on blog posts is the truth."
"No," he said, shaking his head and smiling like a shark. "Lies. Nothing but lies from an ungrateful slut."
Darmana, long used to insults, didn't flinch, but instead gave him a smile of her own, angry and triumphant.
"Go ahead and insult me,"
she crowed, shaking the cell phone.
"Every word you just said is going out to people all over the world."
"No," said Stafford. "It is not."
It took her a few seconds to process that.
"What?" "Look at your phone," he said, still a smiling shark.
She did. Instead of a link to a YouTube channel run by a political blogger in Jakarta, the screen read, "No signal." She glanced around and saw a few other people in her group, and many among the crowd of townsfolk were also frowning at their phones.
"It's called a jammer," said Stafford. "Not a word of what we've said here has gotten out to anyone, and nothing those busybodies in this rabble," he jerked his head toward the crowd behind him, "has gotten out. Not one word."
Damana stared at her blank screen, and then up at the man.
"It doesn't matter," she said weakly. "We're not going to budge until—"
"Shut the fuck up," said Stafford.
The words froze Darmana to the spot.
What did you—"
"Shut your mouth
and listen to me,"
said Stafford in a voice pitched loudly enough for everyone to hear him. "You have one chance left, just one, to stop this bullshit and get back to work."
Dormana looked around and saw the doubt and confusion on everyone's faces, and she saw it transform into alarm and then fear. She turned back to see that the man in black had stepped forward. Behind him, the other two men pushed off from the SUV. One turned toward the onlookers, and the other came over to stand close to the knot of protesters. These men did not smile. They did not speak. Another pair of men got out of the vehicle and produced cell phones. They held them up with the lenses facing the crowd.
"Live streaming now, sir," said one, and the other said he was as well.
Dharmana glanced down at her phone, but it still said no signal. That made no sense to her. How could her phone and all the other phones be jammed and yet allow the two men to live stream? It was a kind of technology she didn't understand, and a chill began creeping up her spine. Something bad was about to happen, but she couldn't imagine what. Why would these people video anything? It seemed the opposite of what thugs like this would want. She looked up into the eyes of the tall, silent man standing close to her, at his face, at his eyes. Moments ago, he'd looked calm, detached, uninvolved with the corporate drama being played out, letting Stafford do all the talking. Now, the man's eyes were filled with life, with strange lights. His mouth trembled as if he were fighting back laughter, but there was a fever brightness to his eyes. Sweat beaded on his cheeks and upper lip. Once more, Dharmana glanced down to see if he had any weapons, but he was unarmed. The man who called himself Stafford patted the taller man's shoulder. He spoke in a language Dharmana didn't recognize. She thought it might have been German, but she met so few foreigners except the upper management, and they were usually French or British. She had no idea what the man said. What filled her mind was what happened immediately after. The man in black began trembling, shuddering, only a little at first, the way someone would if they felt a Pekong walk over their grave, but the shudder grew instantly worse, and within moments the man in black looked like he was being electrocuted or having an orgasm. There was a strange and appalling ecstasy on his face, twisting otherwise handsome features into a parody of pain or lust or both. She looked past him and saw that the same thing was happening to the other black-clad men. All three of them were having some kind of fit. Their faces flushed as if their blood pressure was spiking. Foamy spit bubbled out from between the lips of the man in front of her. Dharmana backed up, first a single step, and then more, backpedaling as the fit grew more violent. Then all of a sudden those tremors stopped, and the whole street in front of the factory went dead silent. For 2 full seconds, the men in black stared at her and through her and at nothing, and she saw to her horror that the tall man's eyes had changed. The whites had turned a dark, vibrant red.
"Blood eyes,"
she thought with the odd clarity of someone in terrible danger.
"He is a demon."
And that was her very last thought, then or ever. The man in black struck her with such shocking, hideous speed that she never saw his arm move. She did not truly feel the blow that caught her on the side of the jaw. Shock buffered her mind from hearing the sounds of her jaw shattering, just as it masked the wetter snap of her neck vertebrae. She was dead before her heart took the next beat. She crumpled to the ground, unable to hear the high and terrible screams of the rest of the protesters, of the crowd of townsfolk who'd gathered to watch, or of the shrieks of horror and agony that followed as the three men in black moved through the village like a monsoon wind, killing everyone Dharmana had ever known. Stafford stepped over her corpse and walked over to the car, leaned against it, produced a silver cigarette case, and removed a filterless Rothhandel, which he lit with a gold lighter. He dragged in a deep lungful, held it to feel the bite, and then exhaled. The blue smoke swirled in the air as all around the screams rose and rose. He glanced at the two men with cell phones and drew a hand across his throat, telling them to cut the feed. They did.
"You get all that?"
he asked.
"Every bit," said one of the men.
"Sweet."
Michael Augustus Stafford pulled his cell phone out, punched a number, and when it was answered, said,
"Looks great from my end, boss. I think this'll play well in your next showroom gig."
"Excellent work," said Mr. Sunday. "The buses of replacement workers will be there first thing in the morning."
"Righto."
Stafford ended the call and smiled. He loved days like this. Made him glad to be alive. Chapter 23. Integrated Sciences Division, Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece. Dr. Jane Holliday sat with Church and Bug at a small table in the lab. The rest of the staff were busy working, but they knew better than to pester the boss and two department heads. There were glances thrown that way, though, and even some unapologetic eavesdropping.
"The problem is," said Doc, "that we know too much and not enough."
Her masses of blonde hair had spilled out of the bun and hung unevenly around her face, making her look like she'd just come in from riding a horse on a windy heath. Bug snorted. He was bleary-eyed and unshaven.
"Welcome to Rogue Team International, where that is on everyone's page-a-day calendar for any day ending in a Y."
"You're not wrong," said Church. His only concession to the long hours since Ledger had gone off the radar was that he'd taken his suit jacket off and tugged the knot of his tie loose. He still looked immaculate.
They had cups of coffee and a plate of cookies. Church was nibbling on his fourth vanilla wafer, and no one else seemed interested in cutting into his supply. Doc had a bunch of animal crackers laid out like a parade and was biting off bits of each animal but not eating any whole cookies. Bug sat there slowly unscrewing double-filled Oreos and eating the cream. Only when he finished the fillings did he begin eating the cookies.
"Ron Coleman and Isaac are studying the cybernetic implants on the patients we brought from Croatia. Right now there seem to be several kinds of implants. Some have neurochips, and there's research suggesting that the chips are designed to interface with add-on gear like a targeting helmet, exoskeleton, or even drones. And there are implants that Coleman is certain will trigger the release of different kinds of chemicals. Some of these chemicals are natural to the body, so the implants regulate those. Dopamine, for example. Or they can sync with a med pack pre-filled with drugs. Modifications of modafinil and armodafinil, for sure. They act as selective and atypical dopamine reuptake inhibitors. And then there's adrafinil, which serves as a prodrug for modafinil. And a prodrug is a compound or medication that, once administered and metabolized into a pharmacologically active drug, controls and improves how the drug is absorbed, distributed, metabolized, and excreted. And we also found experiments with other eugeroics, the norepinephrine dopamine reuptake inhibitor solriamfetol and pitolisant, which acts as a histamine receptor antagonist and inverse agonist."
"Interesting," said Church.
"And there are other compounds referenced that we haven't found details on yet. One in particular is R33. There are notes saying that it's promising. The tests are showing it to be stable for field use, though of limited duration, and a list of side effects, including possible heart trauma. But we have a ton of stuff to go through, and there's the encrypted stuff, so maybe it'll be in there."
"So," said Church, "hit me with your most compelling theories. What is it you think we're learning?"
Bug and Doc exchanged a long look and then shrugged. Doc said,
"These naughty boys are planning something very big and very bad that will involve cybernetically and chemically enhanced PMCs. Probably top-tier fixers," said Bug. "They'd be the ones most solidly under Santora's control."
"His cult of killers," agreed Doc.
Church tapped crumbs from his cookie onto his plate.
"To what end?"
Enhanced military contractors are hardly a new idea. We've taken down at least 9 groups with that agenda.
We have, said Doc, and 2 of those were since I've been your chief mad scientist, but it's remarkable, perhaps significant, that much of the R&D for those older cases is included in what Top brought back.
Oh yeah, said Bug, the Jacoby stuff and all.
How much of it is material likely stolen from us during the hack a few years ago? Asked Church.
A bunch, said Bug. A lot more than I thought had been taken at the time. There's even a good chance, call it 99.9%, that some of this was stuff stolen by Artemisia Bliss.
Church chewed for a moment in silence. Bliss had been a protege of Doc's predecessor, Dr. William Hu. She'd been a brilliant research scientist, analyst, and strategic thinker, but she'd gone badly astray. Church had fired her and then had her arrested for theft of data and technologies obtained after the takedowns of some of the more dangerous groups and cartels the DMS faced. Then Bliss faked her death and reinvented herself as a firebrand among the anarchist crowd. This new persona, Mother Night, had done a lot of damage, had broken into one of the most secure bioweapons storage facilities, and tried to release the Saif al-Din pathogen, the single most dangerous bioweapon Church's teams had ever faced, at a science fiction convention in Atlanta.
But don't get me wrong, Mr. Bossman, said Doc. There's a lot of new science here, too.
Some of that's based on stolen R&D, too, though, said Bug. I'm finding fingerprints and what amounts to computer watermarks on lots of the data files. Stuff looted from the Department of Defense and maybe 40 other places, including a lot of universities. Their mainframes are so easy to hack, they might as well not even try to use encryption, though there's stuff here from some private corporations, stuff that was much better protected, and from companies that I'm pretty sure aren't in any way tied to the Cougar brand.
What's the rest? Asked Church.
Totally new stuff, said Doc.
Without a doubt, said Bug.
Tell me, Church said.
There are 3 areas these bad boys seem to be focusing on. First is surgically implanted technologies. True cybernetics.
I'll be back, said Bug in a fair impersonation of Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Second area, continued Doc, is a new generation of body armor that's really a kind of exoskeleton. In their notes, they refer to it as a CR, shorthand for combat rig, and there are references to several models or perhaps generations of it, K-14, K-57, K-79, and so on. Most recent generation is the K-110.
I'm guessing the K is for Kuga, ventured Bug.
That'd be my guess, Sugar, agreed Doc. And I have to tell you boys that if these jokers decided to go straight and simply patent this stuff, they'd probably get rich as Croesus selling it to the various official military or private military markets. We're talking billions. Some of this is really freaking awesome.
Because they have an actual evil master plan, said Bug.
It was only partly a joke, and no one laughed.
Besides, some of these innovations are based on stolen science. Sure, the finished product may be new, but anyone can reverse engineer it and see what came out of other labs.
There's that, conceded Doc.
She flipped open a folder and showed a schematic for a bulky exoskeleton.
See this? I ran an image and data search, and what did I find? This is a variation of the Guardian Exo full-body exoskeleton by the Sarcos company. It was marketed as the first battery-powered industrial integrated robot, which means it has machinery run by software but integrates with the driver's commands. It augments operator strength but doesn't inhibit freedom of movement. The difference is that the Sarcos one is used mostly for industrial work, lifting, and so on. But see here?